Greetings, greetings, fellow Whogazers, and welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Target novelizations in publication order. My name is Jason, your host on this journey, this very long journey. We are up to January 1977 on the Target calendar. It is a new year. And before we talk about the book, let's talk about the week that Jason had. This has been, obviously, a very rough week here in the States, and I do want to touch on it briefly before I get into the actual story that we'll be talking about. You heard me mention last week about the TV series Better Call Saul, one of my favorite TV shows ever and a show that has great personal meaning for me. The final season is airing this year, 2022, but has been broken up into two parts. So on the Monday before this episode releases was the mid-season finale for the final year. Emotionally, a very rough episode. A major character meets a very tragic and unexpected, if not to say shock, end at the conclusion of the episode. And that rattled me. I guess I can just say it. I had a little bit of trouble falling asleep that night. It took me a couple of hours to unwind after watching that episode. And I thought, isn't it great that a television show could have this kind of power over me? And, of course, the next day that paled into comparison because of the mass homicide down in the school in Texas, which I don't know what it is going to take a certain political party in the Senate to actually act on sensible gun control measures, but that is a subject for a different type of show entirely. Needless to say, my grief over the ending of a particular character on Better Call Saul immediately disappeared, and I haven't thought about the series at all since then. What's happening in Texas is so much more immediate and horrifying and real. And then on Friday evening, my kid and I watched the first episode of Obi-Wan Kenobi, the miniseries on Disney+, which is the return of Ewan McGregor to the role. And I thought that would be a nice distraction from the insanity of the real world. Unfortunately, and this is considered a minor spoiler for the first 3 or 4 minutes of the first episode of Obi-Wan, so if you don't want to be spoiled, just fast forward about 60 seconds. But the first couple of minutes of the episode is a flashback to the massacre of the younglings in episode 3. The series taking place about 10 years after the events of the movie episode 3. And it revisits some characters who survive the massacre. And my kid is watching this with me. She's 11 years old. And she keeps saying over and over again, they're doing lockdown drill in hard mode. Lockdown drill in hard mode. And that hit me, of course, like a ton of bricks, because children these days do have to do lockdown drills, which I did not have to do when I was her age in the mid-1980s. And it just devastated me that she has to encounter the world in this way and think about even a TV show like Obi-Wan with such precision. So that definitely hampered my enjoyment of the rest of the episode, as well made as it is. But, of course, you're not here to listen to me talk about American politics or even about Star Wars. We are here to discuss Doctor Who, and we do have today a fun novelization. So let's set aside the worries of the real world for the next 90 minutes. We're going to welcome back my good friend Pete Lambert to the program, and Pete and I are going to time travel back to 1926, the Jazz Age. We're going to meet some flappers. We're going to meet some sailors. Let's get to it. And I am joined once again by Pete Lambert. Pete was last heard on this show on episode 12 when we discussed the dialogue and vocabulary of the novelization of The Moonbase, Doctor Who and the Cybermen by Jerry Davis. The book we are discussing today does not quite have the same level of vocabulary, so you are not going to hear the word radiophonic today quite as much as you heard it in episode 12, which did win an award for most times using the word radiophonic in a single one-hour program.
That's something to be proud of, I'm sure.
Pete, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here again.
Now, you and I actually recorded an episode for Trap One last week discussing Galaxy 4. So we are now recording programs on back-to-back weeks. Where else can our listeners have heard you during the 3 months or so since you have last been on Doctor Who Literature?
I do tend to pop up everywhere, I'm afraid. But I've had fun doing reviewing Stones of Blood with Joe on Hamster with a Penknife, and of course Trap One. And we've recorded but not yet released the second series of the Blake 7 podcast, Maximum Power, which will be coming out soon. We've just got to finish editing. We do editing and everything on that one, so it takes ages, but it is on its way.
Yes, I do my editing on this show on Saturday nights before a Sunday morning release, and it's not very professional, but I haven't had any complaints.
You're innisloiding it, as I observed the other day.
Yes, you were surprised that I was only recording a few days before broadcast, and yes, Innis Lloyd was famous during, I think it was season 4 of Doctor Who, and every episode was recorded after the previous episode had already been released. So, for example, when they shot episode 4 of The Underwater Menace, it was 6 days before airtime, and it was the day after Joseph First stared into the camera and said, "Nothing in the world can stop me now!" So when they aired that scene, they had not even filmed the resolution yet.
It is incredible that they didn't have more trouble than they ended up having with sickness or whatever, you know. Then you get moments like the Mind Robber, of course, with Fraser Hines suddenly being away at the last minute,
or even the Green Death, which was shot with a reasonable amount of lead time before air. You had the character Elgin, I think it was chickenpox, and had to be quarantined, and they just replaced him with their stock voice actor Roy Skelton playing a different character with a different name, fulfilling the exact same plot function.
It's a real that's flying by the seat of your pants, but it makes it more of a vital feeling, I suppose.
Well, this is a very seat of your pants broadcast meant for a very niche audience. In fact, I want to point out, Pete, that yesterday, speaking of Innis Lloyding it, you ran a poll on your Twitter account adjacent to Carnival of Monsters and some of the vocabulary choices used in this book. Unfortunately, not about the word radiophonic. More people voted in that poll than have ever listened to a single episode of this show.
Really?
So maybe that's going to be what turns the corner for us. Maybe that poll is going to be the gateway to getting us to a wider audience of more than a few dozen people.
It's got to be. It's such a good podcast. So I asked people whether, in their opinions, the exact way I phrased it was, do you think Drashigs have legs? And the options were no, they wriggle, or yes, they scurry. And it was a resounding victory for the wrigglers, the legless Drashigs. But as we'll come to it in a while, I'm sure that that's a contentious issue with this book.
I actually voted for scurry because Twitter doesn't show you the results until after you voted. So anytime I vote, I always assume that I am resoundingly in the right. And then I found out that I was being outvoted, I think 77-23.
Yeah, it's ended at 87-13 in favor of legless Drashigs.
Wow. See, I always assumed the Drashigs had legs. I don't know if there's textual evidence for that on TV or if I just had it in my head for no particular reason.
Well, did you read the book first before you saw it? Because in the book they do.
I did read the book first.
That'll be it. Yeah, it planted that seed.
Planted the Yarrow seed under 3 Megampods.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Which is how the story ends on the episode 4 cliffhanger. Is Pletrak ever going to figure out that he's being scammed by Vorg? And I tuned in the following week hoping to see Carnival of Monsters episode 5 to see if Pletrak was going to lose all of his money playing this game. But instead, we got Frontier in Space Part 1, which, for my money, is a much, much better story. But again, that is my minority opinion, shared by nobody else in fandom.
Well, it's a bigger story, but I like the smallness of Carnival of Monsters.
So let's talk about the physical copy of the book first. As this is a radio show and not a YouTube show, I'd like to bore the audience by discussing our physical copies of the book that nobody else can see. So what I have here, Pete, in case you didn't know it, is the fifth edition, the 1984 edition. which has the very pleasing yellow border around the cover illustration. I think in print or in publication order, it's the first Doctor book to have a yellow spine reprint. I think Ark in Space was later the other yellow spine
book. That's right. They really stand out on the shelf, don't they? Yeah.
And then the back cover is the American version with Lyle Stewart Incorporated in Secaucus, New Jersey, with his flash on the back, and the American price, $2.95. And what is your version?
So mine is very much from the same stable, but not the same imprint exactly. Mine is also the yellow edition with the green, striking green logo and the dinosaur on the front. But this is the version printed, I'll check, because it's the third impression. So originally printed 77, second impression 79, third impression 1980. And that set me back 85 pence back in the day. And this is a real pivotal moment for me, this one. And the reason I leapt on this story when you asked if there's any I'd like to come back to do is because this was the first time I spent money on Doctor Who merchandise of any kind, my first book, just my first anything. It was, and because of knowing the broadcast dates, I can date it. It was the end of November 81, so I'm just over 8 years old. And I'd gone to my mum, into town with my mum to W.H. Smith's, and I was going to buy, and I did buy, my last ever Enid Blyton book. I don't know if she was as ubiquitous elsewhere as she was in the UK, but certainly, and because I had, by the 80s, she was very old, very old-fashioned, but because I had older siblings, I had 60s and 70s Enid Blyton books knocking around the house about children having all sorts of adventures, often reflective of the time in terms of their problematicness. Honestly, Doctor Who is a walk in the park compared to some of that, in terms of the things that you have to wrestle with. She was not all that progressive, although she was very progressive on the women's rights side of things, but not so much the others. But anyway, so I bought the final one edition, I completed my collection of books about the Faraway Tree, in which a kid called Joe finds an everyday British thing, a tree, which can transport you to mysterious worlds where you'll have strange adventures, but you've got to be careful you don't get captured and unable to get back home via the tree. So this is not the hugest leap of genres, actually, because then I picked up this Enid Blyton book, and then next to it on the shelf in the children's section, I'd noticed there were Doctor Who books too. And Doctor Who had just become my favourite TV programme because of the repeats, the five faces of Doctor Who repeats that were shown in towards the end of 1981 to prepare us for the arrival of Peter Davison. I'd caught it occasionally in Tom Baker's last year or two, but only the odd episode. But this series got a lot of promotion, and it was on just after I got home from school, and they were stripping four-part stories Monday to Thursday. So it was perfect timing, and you got really excited about the cliffhangers and their resolutions. So yeah, this is my first piece of Doctor Who merchandise, and the first time I read a story, obviously, I was reading it after having seen it as well. So it was a memory jogger. And very nicely, I managed to get it signed by 3 years ago. I got it signed by Katie Manning.
Oh, wow. Look at that. To Pete, much love, XO Katie Manning. That's amazing.
And that was, I think she did a sort of just an evening with Katie Manning in Liverpool as a one-off thing. It wasn't a Doctor Who event specifically, but obviously she talks about Doctor Who a lot. But it was an actor giving a chat, being interviewed type of event, which I think was a bit of a relaunch of her into fan circles as well. So yeah, that was a really nice jumping back on point for me, as well as being literally my jumping on point to being a Doctor Who fan.
I met her at Gallifrey One in Los Angeles, but unfortunately, as a sign of my advancing years, I think it was February 2017, and it was at a guest reception, so I met her in the same hour that I met Prentice Hancock and Paul McGann and Daphne Ashbrook. And Paul McGann was in a very, very morose mood because Trump had just taken office about 3 weeks earlier. So he spent his time on our table with his head down, lamenting the state of American politics. Katie Manning was very, very, very bubbly, and she is everything you think she is. And she was just, you cannot walk away from that table without being utterly in love with Katie Manning. Very, very, very friendly and, you know, showed direct. There were like 10 of us at the table. You have maybe 5 minutes with each guest. And she was able to have an in-depth conversation with every single person at that table in about 5 minutes' time. I've never seen anything like it.
It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, cues can certainly build up when she gets going, but she's got the knack now, hasn't she, of doing it in a digestive format, I suppose, to make sure that everybody gets to have a bit of time with her and that her chaperones don't end up having breakdowns as they see the queue extending.
Exactly. So that's a terrific autograph to have. I did not, unfortunately, bring anything to that convention to have her. I'm not really an autograph guy, so I haven't been focusing on that. Maybe I should have.
Yeah, no, I mean, Nora, this was just a really special thing for me. Yeah, I don't collect them as a rule because I don't have the resources or patience. Some people really invest a lot of time and effort in getting them, and that's fantastic. But yeah, no, it was just, okay, I'm going to see Katie Manning. I've got to take my Carnival of Monsters book and see if I can get her to sign it. So that was really nice.
Yeah, I did have Terrence Dix autograph a bunch of my targets when he was a Long Island Doctor Who. That was November 2014, but I no longer remember which books I brought him to sign. So as I go through this podcast, I'm now on the 28th target book. I open one every single time. The only one of the first 28 that I had him sign for me was randomly Terror of the Autons, which I do not recall bringing to him at all. And I guess I'll just find out over the next 100 weeks or so which other ones he signed for me. But my Carnival of Monsters is very unadorned. It's a sign of how unenchanted I was by the television story that I can find the marks that I wrote for episode one, episode two cliffhangers. I couldn't find the mark for the episode three cliffhanger, and then I realized it was buried in mid-chapter, whereas episode two begins with chapter four. You can see my 17-year-old handwriting there.
Yeah.
And then episode three begins with chapter seven, but episode four begins in the middle of chapter nine. And I cramped my mark in there in 1990 in between the very narrow gap between paragraphs.
I think I read somewhere that that was a late change due to episode running times. Does that ring a bell with you? Because all of these episodes overran, and the cliffhanger maybe got moved so maybe that was why maybe Terrence was sticking to the original plan rather than what was broadcast. I don't know.
It certainly makes sense because I know there were a lot of those cliffhangers done in post-production during the Pertwee era. Most famously, the interior decorating tiled floor cliffhanger to part three of Death to the Daleks, which is coming up on this show in about 3 months. Chapter nine is where the cliffhanger should be, and it ends on a really fraught moment. Swaying a little, the Doctor now stood alone, the Eradicator trained on him at point-blank range. Still half unaware of his danger, he was trying to make sense of the noise and confusion around him. He heard Vorg's voice. "Come away, Sherna. The noble master is right. The thing must be destroyed." He heard Pletrak's command. "Detachment! One charge at maximum intensity! Fire!" That's my Peter Halliday, by the way. Too weak to dodge or to run, the Doctor looks straight down the muzzle of the Eradicator. Chapter 10, the Doctor takes over. So yeah, that definitely reads as if it should be the cliffhanger, and it also reads as if the director, I think it was Barry Letts, just got his timing wrong and had to move a whole 90-second segment into part four.
Yeah, I bet that's the kind of juggle that they had to do sometimes, yeah. Yeah, that for the first cliffhanger though, the giant hand reaching in, which is slightly so. Episode one ends with the hand reaching in and grabbing the TARDIS, and I just remember being so excited by that on watching it because I'd figured it. You know, when it's one of those stories where the viewer knows what's happening before the Doctor does. The Doctor is deducing what we've. Well, it's not actually been specifically spelled out to us, but you can clearly cotton on. They must be. The TARDIS must be inside that machine, which adds to the whole lovely parallels between Vorg and Sherna and the Doctor and Joe. That cliffhanger is it's made more. There's more words around it at the end of the book in the version Terrence Dix. Doesn't just say, and then a big hand came in and picked up the TARDIS at the end, you know, because that's such a striking image. He's definitely doing his work here, fleshing it out for narratively around moments like that in particular.
And of course, I have yet to read out my portion of the show, which is my analysis of the text, but I will give you a sneak preview. Chapter 2 in the book ends with Vorg peering into the scope because there's obviously been some sort of outside intrusion, and he sees a miniature blue box, and that is how Chapter 2 ends, which perfectly thematically sets up the following chapter ending, which is Vorg's hand coming out of the sky, opening the top of the ship, and pulling the TARDIS out. So I was following along with the online episode transcript from Chrissy's transcripts sites, and that scene isn't there. So there's no scene on television where Vorg peers into the scope and sees the TARDIS first. So there's no setup on TV the way there is in the book. So I don't know if Terrence was adding that scene by himself to fix, well, not really a gap in the narrative, but at least to give the reader some foreshadowing, or if it was a scene that was intended for TV and then cut. So that I won't know until the Blu-rays and the camera scripts come out for the commercial public. But that is a new moment in the book.
Yeah, and that's really funny to me because this is one where I absolutely have a blended memory of Carnival of Monsters, watching the show 1 week and then reading the book the next week. So it's very hard for me to disentangle them, even having gone back and I've listened to the Katie Manning audiobook prior to coming here to talk to you about it, which is great in all sorts of ways of its own, of course. But yeah, there are things that I can remember seeing on TV that actually like that moment that weren't on TV. They're only in the book, but my memories were so fresh at the time that they all just got embedded together.
So the Five Faces of Doctor Who season airs in, I think, late 1981, and that would have been all four-part stories. Unearthly Child, obviously. Yeah. The Crotons, which at that point was the only surviving four-part Patrick Troughton. That was before we got Tomb of the Cybermen back. Yeah. The Three Doctors. And then Carnival of Monsters, which was shot first, but was the story sequentially aired after Three Doctors. They held it over from season 9. And then Legopolis, is that right? Those five?
That's right, yeah. And there had also been repeats a few months earlier of Keeper of Traken and Full Circle to reintroduce the new companions, which I think also went out, but that was with much less fanfare, and that was just a thing. Here's some Doctor Who repeats, which they did every summer. But this Five Faces season got lots of trailers and things to pull you in, and you'd get, and like, I'd have my older brother telling me, oh, it was much better when John Pertwee was the Doctor and that sort of thing, so encouraging me to watch it. And I think Carnival works. I've seen it described as a very atypical John Pertwee story and then a completely typical Doctor Who story at the same time, because you could put any Doctor in it, any Doctor companion combination, and it would work just as well. It's not got any of the traditional tropes of the, if you're doing a Pertwee retrospective, you're going to go to UNIT, you're going to go to the Green Death or the Demons, but they're not four-parters. But by having the Three Doctors in as well, and I think they lined it up so the Three Doctors was out the week of the 23rd.
Oh, wow.
I think they did, yeah. Then that leading on into Carnival. I think Mask of Mandragora was up for inclusion as well, but they had a week cut off because the pre-Christmas programs had to start, so that the intended season would have been through to Mask of Mandragora and then Legopolis, but they shortened it because of the BBC Two didn't have enough, had schedule congestion, so one had to go, so Tom didn't get two. But it just stood out so well as a series, not like anything else that I was seeing on TV at the time, and just really pulled me in. Yeah.
Now I'm trying to think. So you raise a very interesting point. You say that this is an atypical Pertwee story, and that's obviously because there's no UNIT. This is the first episode scripted after they decided to rescind the Doctor's exile. Now it was made before Three Doctors, which was made in the middle of season 10, and this was made at the very end of the season 9 production block. So they're writing it out of sequence after the Doctor's exile is over. Any land on a random planet and solve a problem story, which is not tying into the usual Pertwee themes. But for two reasons, this might be the most archetypal Pertwee of all. So let's explore that. Mm-hmm. Number one, as you say, you have the parallels. You have Vorg and Sherna are the Doctor and Joe. She is the small, pretty, to use a Terrence Dix expression, female, who is smarter than the male and ends up solving all the problems in the story while letting the male think it was his idea, the way Joe bailed the Doctor out on many, many occasions. The best example of that is the lateral thinking. The Doctor mansplains to Joe what lateral thinking is, and then Joe is the one who actually thinks laterally and solves the crisis of that moment.
Yeah. Let's go sideways. Yeah.
Literally. Let's go into the ship, get some rope in the hold. What are you doing, Joe? I'm thinking sideways, like you said. So that's one reason why this is an archetypal Pertwee, because Vorg and Sherna are a projection of the Third Doctor and Joe. And Vorg mistakes the Doctor for a showman, for a carny, as we would say, and he tries to speak in that very specific and now lost language, which was a very heavy part of the British subculture, but nothing that I'd heard of at all in the States in 1985 or 86 when I would have read this, or maybe 1987, but that's beside the point. But the other way this is a very heavily Pertwee story is it's very, very stealth left-wing politically. And I don't know how obvious that is on television, where it's Robert Holmes doing the writing and doing yet another ethnic slur against Asian people, which was basically Robert Holmes's stock and trade by this point. And that is regrettably retained for the book. But you can see in the book that Terrence loves the political fencing and saber-rattling. And Kallik, Michael Wisher, is the worst kind of isolationist right-wing villain. And the kind of stuff that Kallik says in the book, and thinks in the book as an over-the-top political schemer, is literally identical to about five or six very prominent American politicians and or TV commentators. So this book was meant to be an over-the-top political satire, and it's literally come true. We are living this here in the States, though, minus the Drashigs.
So far, yeah. I mean, and there's the whole thing, is it Britain had entered the common market by this point, and still xenophobia is obviously deployed as a sign that someone's a baddie, and that the hate, and I think there's a push and pull between Dix and Holmes over and a very productive push and pull over what is progressive, what is conservative. There's a so obviously, in all 70s Doctor Who, faceless bureaucrats are the enemy. The bureaucrats stop stuff being done. But that's sometimes some left-wing people think that, and some right-wing people think that too. So it's an interesting that they can pincer movement sometimes. Everyone agrees that it's the faceless bureaucrats are terrible. But then, yeah, it keeps on banging home this message that being afraid of outsiders is stupid and will hold you back. That's absolutely a given through the era. And I know what you mean about the language used but again, that sort of shows it's the old, is it uncle or granddad? I can't remember, on the ship. Is that the moment you're thinking of? Yeah,
the ethnic slur is delivered specifically by Ian Martyr. It's the Andrews character, but it is there is the old man character, Colonel Daly, as well. He also makes some comments about the idleness of the South Asian workers on the ship.
That's it. Yeah, that was where I thought you were coming from.
There's two anti-Asian ethnic slurs, one from the granddad and one from Harry Sullivan.
I couldn't blame Harry Sullivan for that, but I know what you mean. Yeah. And it's funny, I mean, because this is now 50 years ago. And the SS Bernice is 50 years in Joe's past. So the Carnival of Monsters is actually the midway point between now, as we're speaking today, and the disappearance or not of the SS Bernice. And we can talk about time loops and consequences of them, because that would be interesting. But yeah, you mentioned earlier the reverse the polarity of the neutron flow as they get, is my take on it. That was definitely my first exposure to, they call it the Carney language. And of course, it's great that of the Doctor not understanding it when Vorg talks to him in this language, which I did a bit of work on this at university in my degree on communications, and that was in the early 90s, and it was quite hot. There was literature available on it, but not that much, and the debate over whether it counted as a language or whether it's more accurately described as a code, because it doesn't have there isn't a word for the or that sort of thing, but all of these words are to enable. So it was used by people working in circuses communities, by traveling communities, and by gay community. And that's my angle on it, because of having been interested in that. The things they used to get away with in 1960s radio comedy shows. You'd have Kenneth Williams characters and his sidekick talking to each other, and Polari being outrageously gay and outrageously direct about it if you knew what the words meant, at a time when it was still a criminal offence. But most of the audience, it just went over their heads as people talking in some silly made up words. But for everyone else, an increasing numbers of people, as the minds broadened in the 60s, people cottoned onto it and started to get in on the joke. So the TARDIS doesn't speak Polari because it's there. And so the TARDIS, I didn't put this in my essay at university, but if it was a language, the TARDIS would have been able to decode it. So maybe that does mean it's actually a code, if we're talking purely taxonomically here, which isn't really the point. Where I was going with that was, it's funny to me that John Pertwee, having been absolutely at the heart of the British entertainment industry, would unquestionably have known how to speak Polari and what all the words meant, but he has to play the Doctor not getting it. And I like the way that in this one, the Doctor is repeatedly, whenever he's arrogant, it's shown to be a weakness. Whenever he's too self-confident and cocky, Joe turns out to have maybe it's a bit patronizing that she has her simplistic innocence approach to it, but that often is the way of sorting things out rather than being haughty, like with coming up with excuses for that why they're on the ship at the beginning of that time loop sequence. It's not the first time we've had a time loop mentioned in Doctor Who, because there's Claws of Axos where they get put in a time loop, but that's sort of treated as like a flight path almost, isn't it? They're just trapped.
Right, traveling in a figure eight for all eternity. Yeah. So the characters are reliving the same moments over and over again, but they're stuck in a loop. And then Big Finish, of course, gets them out of the loop, but that's a story for another day.
Oh, I've not come to that one yet.
They brought Bernard Holly back, actually, to reprise his role. It was a Sixth Doctor Evelyn Smythe audio.
Oh, right.
It's very good. Oh. Yeah. I'm not a huge Big Finish guy, but that is one of my. That's one of the ones I like better.
It's so-called The Claws of Axos, C-L-A-U-S-E or something, is it? Oh, no, that'll be a Christmas episode. Hey, I'm on fire.
I haven't heard it in about 10, 15 years. I forget the name, but it shouldn't be that hard to find.
No, that's interesting. This is Doctor Who's first Groundhog Day, and something we're very used to seeing in Star Trek, and cropped up in Doctor Who plenty of times since then. But from looking on TVTropes.org, this was not a common thing at all, and it's just certainly that there's a couple of examples of it, I think, in America and Japan in the 60s. But it's not something that viewers would have seen on TV before. This idea of characters trapped going over the same thing again and again, but some of the characters aren't trapped in the bubble. That's actually a very novel concept if you're encountering it for the first time. But I don't remember being confused by it when I was eight. They sold it to me, and Joe saying very very arcanely, it's like they're trapped in a gramophone record. I love the way she says gramophone. What 20-year-old from the 70s or the 80s would say gramophone record? But for some reason, they felt the need for her to say it that way. Maybe because they were in the 1920s and surrounded by racists, she was joining in with the 1920s terminology to try and put us there. Because that is the only thing you can think, why on earth were they doing that? It's like, well, they would say, well, that's how people did speak then, which is not a satisfactory answer by any means, but you can sort of imagine that being where it came from. Sorry, I'm leaping all over the place. I started out talking about Polari.
That's thematically appropriate. So just to do a couple of loops while we're looping around, the Big Finish story that I was thinking of was The Feast of Axos, number 144 in the main range, with Bernard Holly as the voice of Axos. It's a Sixth Doctor and Maggie, but it follows directly on from Claws of Axos and features the same Axos ship. I don't know, of course, if Carnival of Monsters has ever received a Big Finish sequel, but if it hasn't, it would be the only Doctor Who story that never had a Big Finish sequel.
Yeah, and you think the miniscope gives them plenty of scope for doing that.
And Terrence, of course, includes more scenes inside the miniscope, and he puts alien races in the miniscope that were not seen on television, because you can do that in the book. So to do another loop, talking about Polari, the carnival code, I didn't, obviously, growing up in the States, the first time I ever would have heard of that would have been reading Carnival of Monsters in 86 or 87 or whenever I bought it. But the 1996 new adventure novel, Happy Endings, was the 50th new adventure written by Paul Cornell. And I think it was his fifth one for the series. So he was already 10% of the line. And it's the character of Bernice Summerfield is getting married in the future. At that point, I believe it was Earth in the year 2010. And it brings back, not to exaggerate, at a conservative estimate, it brings back 200 characters, either from earlier TV stories and earlier books. And after Benny's character gets married, there's a chapter, a long chapter, that was written in part by every single previous New Adventures author. Even Neil Penswick, who had written just one book. The chapter is called I Think Everybody's Welcome at the Wedding. This being the New Adventures, there were several gay male characters, including, and the books had a very big tug of war on this, is Mike Yates gay, or is Mike Yates the worst kind of dude bro? So when Keith Topping was writing for Mike Yates and the Third Doctor, Past Doctor Adventures, Mike Yates was the biggest slimeball of all, but in Paul Cornell's word, Mike Yates had come out of the closet and was actually living with a character who is implied to be Tommy from Planet of the Spiders. So that's sort of math you have to do in your head. But there's a scene in that chapter where three or four gay male characters are admiring somebody else and speaking in Polari about whether or not that guy is available.
Right.
And then a younger know-it-all character comes up and says, everyone knows you're speaking in code. Why don't you just stop? One of the older men says, just be thankful that you have never had to speak in code, which is a really profound moment, and it's one of the lines of the book that I remember the most of all. And there are two characters, there are two camp Silurians in that book that are directly based on Julian and Sandy from the Kenneth Williams sketches, but as an American 23-year-old in 1996-97, I would not have known that, and it took a RecArch Doctor Who threads and liberal use of Wikipedia for me to put all those threads together 25 years later.
It's fantastic, the knowledge that we can build through our little insights.
But it's all there in Happy Endings, which is in some ways a spiritual sequel to Carnival of Monsters, as well as to every other Doctor Who book ever written up to that point.
In terms of other linguistic things, I'll say now, Terence Dix, God bless him, amazing author, amazing, wonderful things. I just wish he'd included an explanation of what skeleton keys actually were, because they're just mentioned. It just says Joe produces her skeleton keys and opens the door, I think. It's clear what they can do, but what was not made clear to my 8-year-old self was that they weren't actually made out of bones. I just took that as a I'd never heard the word before, and so I labored for quite some time under the misapprehension that the skeleton key was a key made out of bones that you could use to open other doors with. And I was several years older when I remember that coming up in conversation and me being widely derided for having, because you can carry something completely wrongly in your head without it actually being exposed to the light of anyone else realizing you've got it wrong. So that was a formative moment that they're not actually made out of bones. That was one footnote I needed.
My book series obsession before the novelizations was The Hardy Boys, which were a long-running series of adventures here in the States. It was two brothers living in the New York City suburbs, implied to be New Jersey, but never actually come out and said. And their father is a world-famous detective from the NYPD who has gone into private investigation, and the Hardy Boys follow in his footsteps. And that series, the books came out in the mid-1920s, and they are still on TV today in one of those American Network TV series based on the Hardy Boys. So they're still going strong. So I had read probably about half of the original 60 Hardy Boys novels by the time I discovered Doctor Who at age 11. So the Hardy Boys, being teenage amateur detectives, they had skeleton keys, and skeleton keys feature heavily in many, many, many of the Hardy Boys tales. So for me, But then again, I was quite a bit older than you. I would have been about 12 or 13 when I read this, and you would have been just 8 years old and probably hadn't, I don't know how big the Hardy Boys were in the UK, but you almost certainly would not have read them.
No, I hadn't, no.
Another question I wanted to ask you, I'll pull a Joe Ford. Pete, I have a question for you. You mentioned that this story could work for any Doctor and Companion, but I think it's specifically coded as the Third Doctor and Joe just because of the way Vorg and Sherna are written. And Vorg mistakes the Doctor for a carny, for a showman, because of the way he dresses and the way that he acts around authority. Can you picture any other Doctor from the classic series doing this role and being mistaken for a showman?
Yeah, I see what you mean. There would be tweaks. But to be honest, yeah, I mean, the 4th, the 6th, 7th and 8th.
The 7th, obviously, because he was literally a clown before he was cast
yeah,
as a...
Yeah, and the 6th just dressed as one.
right.
The most recent story that I watched prior to revisiting Carnival was Mysterious Planet. And I was thinking about how good how much nicer and softer the good-natured teasing between the Doctor and Perry is in that. And I really was reminded of that then coming straight out of that Robert Holmes story into this Robert Holmes story, that in both of these, he's got this idea, yes, the Doctor can be paternalistic and patronizing, but the Companion can hold her own and can tease him back. And you get the back and forth between these two buddies. There's a very similar tone between Mysterious Planet and this, I think. And I think my earliest experience to Joe had been being seen a very, very poor quality copy of Terror of the Autons. It might have been the Demons, but where she's much less active. No, that's not true, because she's active in... What am I saying? What I'm hedging around here is first seeing Jo and thinking that she was being portrayed unfairly by the story as a bit of an idiot, as inept. But then that's her arc, and she obviously... But what I'm saying is, by the time we get to Carnival of Monsters, she's grown and is much more than the person who's going to drop the Doctor's test tubes and squirt the fire extinguisher on it and things like that. So yeah, I like the way Joe's character has developed by this point, I suppose, is what I'm saying, without meaning to be dismissive of how she starts out. But it is a bit, you know, obviously she is introduced as the antithesis of Liz Shaw, and so then she has room to grow from there, and this is what she's grown into. Katie Manning is quite cheeky on the audio, where she is her voice for the Doctor is very gravelly, and when she says plesiosaurus imitating Pertwee, she does it in a very exaggerated speech impediment issue way, which is quite cruel, except I think because he doesn't when you actually watch the episode. But I think that was a joke between them rather than a joke at his expense.
Terence Dix makes a very heavy joke at John Pertwee's expense, and I won't spoil it now because I'll be reading it out in my script later in the program, but Terence changes a line of dialogue by adding a word on television as an editorial comment on John Pertwee's physical appearance. That's all I'll say.
I think I know the bit you mean, yeah.
So I want to point out, of course, that Robert Holmes was assigned to write Joe's first TV appearance, Terror of the Autons. And when I was watching from my pilgrimage last year in the spring of 2021, it was very uncomfortable watching part one of Terror of the Autons because Holmes goes to town playing up what a stupid idiot Joe is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And Robert Holmes was writing basically one story a year. However, when it comes to season 9, this story was made as part of season 9. I think it was his next Joe's script, because the other stories in season 9 would have been by Louis Marks, by Brian Hales, by Malcolm Hulk, by Bob Baker and Dave Martin, and then by Barry Less and Robert Sloman. So Robert Holmes writes for Joe Grant twice, and this is the second one. And it was made only about a year or so after Terror of the Autons. Joe has come by leaps and bounds. So was Robert Holmes being deliberate by writing the two stories this way to show how much Joe had improved as a character?
Yeah, I'd credit him with that. Or it could have just been more for the beginning of Terror of the Autons, it was a case of we want the exact opposite of Liz Shaw in every way, and then she's going to grow from there. And maybe this was all. So I don't know if this is a so much a correction of what they started out with as being the destination that they were probably heading to all along, because she's going to be an apprentice who's going to learn. But yeah, I think they really overdid it in that Terror of the Autons episode. She's she's seen as a liability rather than just being inexperienced. But that does turn around, yeah.
It was probably considered ha-ha funny. Look at the ditzy blonde in 1971. But watching it now, more than half a century later, of course, we have definitely changed our perspectives for the better on many, many such issues. Same as with the ethnic slurs that are dropped in the story so casually by multiple characters. Unthinkable today, but back then you would just say it and nobody would blink.
And Bechdel-wise, though, this is a good one. We get to have Joe having conversations with Claire where they're on the ship, where they are just discussing she's trying to make her realize, Joe is trying to make Claire realize what's happening, and just trying to get through to her person to person, which is not something you get in every story by a long shot. I think both the actors who play Claire and Cherno, I think I read, were on the shortlist to play Joe Grant that Barry Letts originally had, which is why he cast them both. He promised that he told them both, "You're great, but you're not right for this part," and that they then. But then, when he was directing this, he brought them both back to make true what he said, that they did make a good impression on him. And Cherno is an amazing character, I think. And I mean, she overshadows Vorg because that's her job, but the pair of them are just so good, just dramatically having the you don't hate them. You don't hate him, despite all of his bluster and that he's a blagger. They're very familiar characters too. They could be from any British sitcom. A couple of entertainers that people meet. You know, they don't need to be aliens. They don't need to be in space. They're really recognizable 70s or 80s UK TV characters, I think. And in fact, because he goes on to play Punch and Judy Man in Heidi High for many years, where he's just a complete child-hating bastard who's always drunk, and that's pretty much that's his character basically in that, it's utilized to much comic effect in his as his part at the campsite entertaining the kids that he hates.
And the character of Claire is identified as a flapper. She has that very unique 1920s hairstyle. A lot of my time on YouTube is spent in watching YouTube videos for Annette Hanshaw songs from the late 20s, and it's almost an identical hairstyle. I think Claire is the only self-identified flapper in the history of Doctor Who, which didn't spend nearly enough time in the 1920s as it could have done. But isn't Claire another character where she is kind of overlooked by the two men in her life, the Colonel and Harry Sullivan, but she winds up being the smartest one of the three because she's the only one who realizes that she's trapped inside of a time loop?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
where she sees it with her philosophy more than with her eyes, but she's definitely aware that something is going on.
Yeah. There's that, not just if you only believe what you can see with your own eyes, you might not see everything, which is the case for because they literally we don't get the phrase perception filter yet, but the fact that they can't see the hatches, nobody can see the hatches in the ship, so they assume that there's nothing there. But people who are able to see the bigger picture and notice stranger things. Can be the ones who actually solve the mystery.
So for you, you read this book first more than 40 years ago now. What was it like going back and reading it in 2022? And how did it compare to the way you absorbed it when you were 8 years old? Obviously, it's much shorter now than it would have been when you were eight.
Yeah, and it's a show I'm probably more familiar now with Carnival of Monsters, having seen it many times, than I was having just seen it the once when I first got it. But you notice things that have been changed, like, for example, it's Terry Nation replaces Robert Holmes's Tellurians with Terrans, which is more down to earth and more scientifically what aliens might call us if they called our earth terra firma, which they wouldn't. So that's one of those strange things, because the Tellurians come back in Robert Holmes scripts a few more times, don't they? It's in Two Doctors, and I think
I will make a direct parallel between Carnival and Two Doctors during my script later on in the program, so again I don't want to preempt that, but I did notice that
And I think it was Terrence. This was, I think, Terrence Dix rather than Terry Nation. But yes, he does go back and change every instance of Tellurian to Terran.
You could say that Terran's sticks as a term when he's writing it.
I wrote that pun in my script later on.
Oh, so. Damn. That was me thinking I'd come up with a new one.
Well, great minds think alike. And since this is being recorded and put on the program before...
That's very kind of you.
Take credit for coming up with the idea before I did. Nobody will ever know the difference.
I was impressed while listening to this. By the way, yeah, if you want to listen to the audiobook of this and you haven't, if you go on Audible, if you just type in Carnival of Monsters, you get just this book on its own for one credit. But if you search for books narrated by Katie Manning, it takes you to Doctor Who, The Monsters Collection, Volume 2, which includes this and several others not narrated by Katie Manning. So you actually get like six for your credits. The Sontaran Experiment and some others. I think it's five or six, I think. So if you are feel like doing that, have a dig around because your credit can go further. The pursuit, when they're being pursued by the Drashigs, is just really exciting prose. I was impressed by how that I forgot that I was listening to it with a view to doing a review and was actually excited about how the Doctor and Joe were going to escape from the Drashigs that were striding after them on their strong, swarthy Drashig legs, which takes me back to what I said at the beginning. That's another Terrence. I guess he decided he didn't want them to look like puppets, so he decided that they definitely have legs in this. But the TV screen wins out on that front, I suppose.
Terrence does take the opportunity to, I'll use a Polaria word, to zhuzh up the narrative a little bit by when the Inter-Minor characters are looking at the miniscope on television, they're just peering into a peep show. And again, here in the States, the word peep show has a very different connotation than it does the way that Terrence and Robert Holmes use it. But on TV, they just peer into the scope. In the book, Terrence decides that they are actually transported into a virtual world, so they appear to be standing on the planes with the Drashigs. So Terrence has certainly thought about how the miniscope might work, and he definitely punches it up a little bit.
It's immersive, isn't it?
Yes.
And one phrase that really leapt out at me when they're discussing, because, and you talked in the recent episode about Pyramids of Mars, about how actually Terrence makes the death of the poacher seem more horrific because he's being killed. Now he's, the hunter becomes the hunted, and it's quite, we get the poacher's death from his point of view. And that made me listen out for things like that, because one sometimes imagines Terrence Dix as being someone who would maybe take out some of the horror for kids, and in fact sometimes he goes a bit harder. And there's a bit in here, it's not horror, but it's horrifying, when he talks about what the choking darkness that would envelop the character people in the miniscope if it when its power runs out, and their world and their lives would end in choking darkness. And that would have, I'm sure my 8-year-old self was a little bit freaked out by that as a concept, because that's just a little casual phrase, but it's very haunting. And there's a little bit of politics at the end, going back to what I was saying about what we've been saying throughout about the push and pull of progressivism, and does that mean conservative v Labour or whatever. But there's a joke from the Doctor right at the end about maybe Vorg. Someone says Vorg Joe says he'll probably be president within a few months, jocularly. And the Doctor replies, yes, or Chancellor of the Exchequer. And that was at a time of a Labour government putting in very high taxes in the UK. So that may have been Terrence putting in a little bit of satire on that contemporarily, or it could have just been a general joke about chancellors of the exchequer.
Now, for me, of course, neither the word chancellor nor exchequer are words that are used here in the States. We would call it the Secretary of the Treasury, the very first of whom, of course, was Alexander Hamilton back in 1789. As you may have heard from a particular Broadway show. But yeah, I would not have known what Chancellor of the Exchequer meant. I might have guessed money because the word check, I knew that check was spelled differently in the UK than it's spelled here, Chequue, whereas here it's Check. I probably would have guessed, but I would have heard that expression before, so the Carnival of Monsters book would have been my introduction to that term. So that definitely takes away from the power of the joke, if it is a joke, at least on my end.
Yeah.
So we've talked about Carnival of Monsters on television. We've talked about some of the politics. We've talked about some of the language. We've talked about the strong female characters. Although I will talk later in the program about how Terrence sort of hedges his bets a little bit and makes Jo a little bit dumber in the book than she appeared on television, unfortunately. Ooh. And we've talked about Drashigs. We've talked about Polari. Before we move on to the final part of our conversation, what else can we say about Carnival of Monsters, the book? Does it hold up? And I ask this every time. Is this perhaps the definitive Terrence Dicks novelization?
I wouldn't say definitive, but I would say it's definitely up there. But then I don't know if there can be a definitive, because the whole point of Doctor Who is that you get a different style and tone every week. So there can't be one. There can't really be one Doctor Who story. But so I still think Dalek Invasion of Earth is probably my favourite Terrence Dick book. And this is where there's a pause where I'm in fear that you're going to say he didn't write that one, because that's just coming off the top of my head. He did, didn't he?
I just cast my interview guest for the Dalek Invasion of Earth episode, and that's coming up in, I want to say, 2 or 3 more weeks on this program. So you will get to hear somebody with intimate knowledge of the targets talking about Terrence Dicks' writing style versus the Terry Nation scripts. I will not say who it is, but I'm very much looking forward to recording that episode, because I don't think this is a definitive Terrence Dicks book. I think he's done better. However, when I was reading it and comparing it to the TV episode transcript, I think Terrence does a remarkable job improving the narrative flow. And he certainly really, really enjoys talking about the politics. And I think it's an amazing book. I'm not very fond of the TV story. TV story is strictly middle to lower tier for me. I can see what it's trying to do, but it doesn't speak to me the way that, for example, season 7 would speak to me or season 18 would speak to me. It's just there. But I think that the book is a tremendous improvement over the TV serial in many ways. So it's not the best Terrence Dicks. And if you're talking about the best Terrence Dicks, last week, Pyramids of Mars, I think, is one of the best. Talking about Dalek Invasion of Earth coming up in a few weeks, that is one of the best. So this is a really, really good book, but for me, it's not the greatest Terrence of all time. It just shows that even in a run-of-the-mill book, he can do remarkable magic to a story, but there's better out there.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I do start, obviously, from a higher vantage point, a higher opinion of the source material, but still agree that it gives it an extra polish, yeah.
All right, and speaking of polish, it is now time to polish off this conversation by playing a game. Now, the games obviously came to the show after you appeared last on episode 12. I began those with episode 16. So if you've been listening to the program, you know you have a choice of games. And which choice would you like to play today?
I don't know. I go with the random stories one. The guess the story.
All right, so yeah. You have a game of 20 questions as your selection. I have randomly pre-selected from randomizer.net one Doctor Who tale between 1963 and 2022. You have 20 yes or no questions to solve. The record, of course, is held by Cy Hart, who solved it in 7 because Cy. Nobody has lost the game yet. One person took 16 or 17 tries, but nobody has lost the game yet. Hopefully you are not the first.
We'll see. I like to be a groundbreaking person in any way that I can. So if I do, then I'm going to say that that's why. Okay. So question one is going to be how many
questions.
Is it a story? Is it set on Earth? That's question one.
Yes, it is set on Earth.
Okay. I'm writing these down so that I don't ask the same question twice by accident as we go. Does the Doctor only have one regular companion at the point of this story? And I'll take that you might have a different definition of companion to anyone else. Is it something that you personally would think of as a story with only one companion or more than one companion?
It's hard to answer that without being a spoiler, but I would say this is a story that is generally considered to have two companions. that's not a yes or no question, but to answer your question, no, it is not, from my perspective, solely a one companion story.
Yeah. For some reason, because I'm thinking, what chops Doctor Who in half? Like, yeah, it's not. Okay, so, and the obvious one, is it a classic series episode?
No.
So it's new series.
We're up to question 4 now.
Okay. Is it a David Tennant episode?
No. Question 5.
Is it set in the present day?
Yes. Question 6.
Is it... is it a Chibnall era episode? Is it a Jodie Whittaker episode? Yeah, that's the best way of putting it.
Yeah, so by, it is not Chris Chibnall in any sense. And now we are up to the fateful question 7. If you can guess it in 1, you will have tied Simon Hart's record. When Mark was on the show last week, he just went for the fences by guessing a random story with his first question, because if he got it right, he would set an all-time record. And he missed by quite a bit. But with your question 7, you do have a chance of tying the record.
Okay. And it's you were quite vehement that it's not a Chibnall episode, so I'm going to even take... I'm going to overread into that, that he didn't write it either.
That is indeed what I meant.
Is it Hellbent?
No, it is not Hellbent.
Okay.
Question 8.
This is where my weakness on the new series is going to start showing. Is it a Capaldi episode?
Yes.
Okay. Is it has it got Bill Potts in it?
Yes. So now we are at question 10. If you can solve it now, yeah, and that narrows it down quite a bit because Bill was only on for the 1 year, you can get it in half the time, 10 out of 20. That would be one of the better scores on this show.
Okay, but there's still quite a lot. I mean, there's still only a less than a 1 in 10 chance that I'm going to guess correctly. Is it the pilot?
Yes, it is. It is the pilot.
Wow.
Now, that was a very risky strategy, my friend. Because if you had gone through the entire sequential run of Series 10 stories, you might actually have run out of time, because I don't believe Chibnall wrote for that season. So
you should have made
it all the way up to Twice Upon a Time without ever guessing. But you are lucky by going in chronological order. Yes, it did happen to be the pilot. So you got it. You got it.
Hey, I'm very relieved that I haven't ended up with egg on my face. My next thing would have been, I guess, how many episodes long is it? I don't know how I would have narrowed it down more. Once you get down to sort of 10 or fewer stories, it's quite hard to come with ways that will just think a thing that will split them in half, isn't it? That should be the objective.
Right, and if you listen to other episodes of the show, some people are very, very methodical, and they just rule out era by era by era. You were going thematically, and obviously, there's no wrong way to play then, because you got it in 10, which is better than some folks who did it methodically, but worse than other folks who did it methodically. So your approach was actually pretty good. 10 is one of our better scores.
My non Mavellan approach, doing it with follow a hunch rather than But yeah, it was that thing of what can cut Doctor Who in half, what can cut the remainder of Doctor Who that we've now got left in half, was my the closest thing I had to a strategy.
And I have now reloaded the randomizer, and we will have a different story discussed the next time somebody chooses to play this game. So that is randomizer. It is therandomizer.net. I use a different randomizer if you were to have played Guess That Cliffhanger, but it's been a couple of weeks now where nobody's chosen to play Guess That Cliffhanger, so I guess the 20 questions is the more popular game.
Well, I did think Guess That Cliffhanger might just be too hard.
But you don't know, you did very well. You are a winner on 20 questions, so the next time you're on the show, maybe you can try a different game.
Yeah, okay. I'll be braver next time and have a go at that. And I wanted to ask you, actually, I mean, this is a discussion to have afterwards, but it occurred to me, the two that I've done have been books that I've got lots of childhood memories of, and obviously my appreciation of them is completely wrapped in that, and maybe that blinds me to some other aspects of them, which you've raised. But so there was a point, though, in my target book buying, where I became a collector more than a reader. And this is where I'm going to be frank, and we can have, I know I'm in a safe space, or I hope I'm in a safe space to admit, there's a fair few Target books that I bought and never got around to reading, because I ended up getting them on video when I was in my mid-teens from Australia. So I would love to do one someday with you. I don't know if you've got a very, very busy schedule, but I'd love to do one and actually read it for the first time and talk to you about that. That would be my... If you've ever got another slot coming up someday, that would be a great one to put me into.
See, I had a similar experience. I was getting these books, two books or three books, every 2 weeks, depending on how much babysitting I had done for my kid's sister during the 2 weeks before our bi-monthly trip, or is that the right word? Every 2 weeks trip to the bookstore. So yeah. At the beginning, I would come up with three books, then I would read them by the end of the weekend. I would read three books in 36 hours. As I moved on, and I was doing more and more babysitting, I was getting eventually more and more books every 2 weeks. So there came, and then of course I was into junior high school, and I was getting heavily back into baseball, and I was getting into girls, and I started to have jobs. So at some point I was buying the books faster than I could read them. I know for The Mind of Evil and for Fury from the Deep, I read chapter one as soon as I got home from the store, and then deliberately set them aside until I had time. I read chapter one of Fury from the Deep, which is incredible, maybe six or seven times, but it wasn't until I was 20 plus years old that I actually read the entire book all the way through. Now, for you, that's a little more of a challenge because you're buying these probably more in chronological order than I was. You started buying the books 3 years before I did. I am going in publication order. This is only the January 1977 book. I imagine it's going to be several years on the Target calendar before we get to a book that you haven't read. And that could, of course, be, you know, months or years on this show. So we'll sit down after the recording and we'll put you back on the schedule.
It's a bit more patchy than that, actually. That's the funny thing. Yeah, there are some coming up that I know I've not read yet. But yeah.
Yeah, well, if nothing else, we'll have to have you back on twice. Once to discuss an upcoming book that's coming up on my schedule and one to discuss a book that you have never read. Now, it's funny that you mentioned Stones of Blood because I have Stones of Blood coming up on two different podcasts. So the novelization... The second novelization, which is the print version of David Fisher's audio-only script from 10 years ago for The Stones of Blood on CD, I'm covering that for Trap One. That's coming out in a few months' time. And I'm also coming up in about 6 months to the Terrence Dicks novelization from 1980. So I'm going to be covering Stones of Blood twice on two different podcasts in the year 2022. And you have just... has your hamster episode been released yet, or is that one that Joe has recorded and has not yet aired?
Yeah, no, that one's out now. Yeah, that came out a week or so ago, our Stones of Blood episode. It was really fun. Having done Canine and Company, it was like going back and doing the original source material.
Wow. Stones of Blood is very influential for me because there were two Doctor Who stories that I experienced in July 1985 when I discovered that I really, really enjoyed courtroom drama. It was Stones of Blood, which I saw on TV first, and then a couple of weeks later, buying the Keys of Marinus novelization at my very first Doctor Who convention. So Stones of Blood is indirectly responsible for my eventual choice of career, as is Keys of Marinus, which is not... You can't say that too many Doctor Who stories have influenced somebody's career. No. And for somebody to take their career choice from Keys of Marinus and Stones of Blood is definitely atypical, I would say.
Which of them paints the most realistic picture?
Yes. The answer is yes. They're both very realistic. All right, Peter, it was great having you back on, and we'll immediately get you back on the schedule coming up real soon now. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you. That's really nice of you. It's been really fun. I hope everybody has enjoyed thinking about it and the story.
Doctor Who and the Carnival of Monsters, written by Terrence Dix, televised as Carnival of Monsters, or as the book says, The Carnival of Monsters, teleplay by Robert Holmes, televised in January and February 1973, published in January 1977. The Doctor and Joe land on a cargo ship crossing the Indian Ocean in the year 1926, or so they think. Far away on a planet called Interminer, a traveling showman is setting up his live peep show, watched by an eager audience of space officials. On board ship, a giant hand suddenly appears, grasps the TARDIS, and withdraws. Without warning, a prehistoric monster rises from the sea to attack. What is happening? Where are they? Only the Doctor realizes with horror that they might be trapped. We are here on Doctor Who Literature in the middle of a flurry of Robert Holmes TV story adaptations. This is the second straight book, following directly on from last week's Pyramids of Mars novelization, episode 27, adapted from a Holmes TV script, and next week's book, Doctor Who in the Seeds of Doom, was script edited by Holmes, so this is going to be a really good run of books, as Holmes is, of course, the master. One thing I appreciate about Doctor Who and the Carnival of Monsters is that the TARDIS materializes literally on the first paragraph of the first page. Compare that to the Ice Warriors novelization, which Fraser Gregory and I discussed here back on episode 21, where it takes the TARDIS a dozen pages to show up. I appreciate the efficiency. This is a change from TV, where a scene on Interminer comes first, and the TARDIS scene comes second. But changing the scene order, flipping them for the book, allows Terrence to prolong the mystery and work in some of his trademark foreshadowing. This is just an ordinary old cargo ship, Doctor. You've landed us back on Earth. And then he writes, as the terrifying adventure which followed was to prove, Jo had never been more wrong in her life. As we've discussed earlier on Doctor Who Literature, Terrence loves his politics. And Carnival of Monsters, as you'd expect from Bob Holmes, is a very political story. From listening to some of his stray comments on the audio commentaries about 15, 20 years ago, I used to wonder if Terrence wasn't Doctor Who's in-house Tory. But page 10 here is so far left that, well, it's still to the right of many of my friends here in Brooklyn, but it is enjoyable. Terrence leans into the functionaries of Interminer wearing ill-fitting masks by making it a species characteristic. Quote, coarse, lumpy, unfinished features. They look like they've been slapped together out of rough clay by a rather poor sculptor, he writes. And Terrence describes the officials not only as gray-faced and gray-robed, but as, quote, gray-minded, too, for the main part, end quote. And as is his usual way, Terrence introduces two Interminer officials in the same paragraph with such perfect precision that I don't need to tell you they were played by Michael Wisher and Terrence Lodge on TV. Quote, Kallik's bored manner concealed fierce intelligence and burning ambition, while Oram's masked only complacent foolishness. Later in Chapter 2, we learn that Kallik may be the president's brother, but he is, quote, one of the old school, end quote. The miniscope is amusingly described on page 13 as something between a jukebox and a What the Butler saw machine. That latter reference I had to look up. After Kallik shoots the speechifying labor union functionary on page 15 and muses about a medical cause for the man's rebellion, Terrence just comes out and says it, as if he were describing the unionizing Amazon workers on Staten Island or in Alabama of the year 2022. Quote, It did not occur to Kallik that it was not the rebellious functionaries who were abnormal, but the conditions under which they had to live and work. I used to say when I was younger that I was a Mad Magazine liberal, unaware that most of my politics were instilled at age 8 by reading back issues of Mad Magazine, but it's also quite possible that I'm a Terrence Dick Target Books lefty as well. All of this material is heavily restructured from TV. Chapter 1 has just two scenes in it. The single opening scene on Interminer, set after the Doctor and Joe arrive in the TARDIS. A second scene on Interminer that occurred in between two separate Doctor and Joe scenes that were combined from TV into the one longer scene for the book, has been pushed back to Chapter 2. Terrence adds all of that political philosophy about President Zarb and his progressive politics, which is alluded to later in the televised story, but never spelled out on screen in quite such a direct way. Chapter 1 may be one of Terrence's finest and most fun chapters, honestly, well, until Chapter 10, but we'll come to that. Page 19 is a data point
for the unit dating controversy. Joe in the book sees that Major Daly's book has a 1926 copyright date and accuses the Doctor of having taken them back in time 50 years. 1976, when Terence would have written the text of this thing. Now, there is no 50 years reference on TV, where Joe gets the local date from a newspaper, not a book. Fred Astaire is named on TV, but Terence just says Fred something or other in the book, and the reader has to work it out for themselves. Chapter 2 also contains just two long scenes, much condensed from several shorter TV scenes. The mini cliffhanger that serves as the ending to Chapter 2 is invented for the book and is not seen on TV at all. Vorg does some maintenance work on the scope and sees a blue box. That immediately establishes a connection between the TARDIS's landing point and the doings on Interminer that is not present on TV. This added scene allows the young reader to stay one step ahead of the Doctor and sets up the end of Chapter 3, which is the actual TV Episode 1 cliffhanger. Chapter 3 is also substantially cut down from TV, consisting of just a single 9-page scene, the Doctor and Joe's adventures aboard the SS Bernice, in between being captured by Lieutenant Andrews, say hello to young Ian Martyr, and the Episode 1 cliffhanger. Vorg's insistence to the Minoran officials that the miniscope was entertainment, nothing serious, nothing political, fell in the middle of this sequence on TV in Episode 1, but it's been punted back to Chapter 4 in the book. Chapter 3 also contains, however, possibly Terence's funniest censor cut in the whole of the Target range. On both TV and in the book, Major Daly insists to Andrews that they discuss the captured TARDIS travelers civilly over a drink. On TV, the Doctor agrees and orders a large scotch. In the book, aimed at the dry 9-year-old reader, remember, the Doctor orders a small nothing, as Andrews interrupts him after the word small, and the sentence never gets finished. Now that is funny. Reminds me of the time that Elton John came on The Muppet Show to perform Goodbye Yellow Brick Road and cut out the line about vodka and tonics. It's difficult to compare the book and TV episodes, though. The two things are very different entities. The book is very, very compressed from the TV material, and heavily rearranged. Try reading any two consecutive scenes in the book, and then look up the online episode transcript, or watch the story on TV. Those two scenes will doubtless be a composite of maybe 5 or 6 separate TV scenes. And while the material is consecutive in the book, on TV you might find, say, in Chapter 4, a lot of Interminer scenes from Episode 1 pushed back to fit alongside a Joe and the Doctor scene from Episode 2. It's confusing to take in, and the book does delete a lot of funnier TV lines. We lose, for example, this amusing exchange from Episode 1.
Oh, it slides open.
How does it work?
Anti-magnetic cohesion, I should think.
Never heard of it.
No, you wouldn't have done, Joe. You were born about 1,000 years too early for that.
Oh, I do love being with you, Doctor. You make me feel so young.
In place of that scene, in the book we're given a truly intriguing scene where Pletrak, Peter Halliday, approaching Vorg and Cherna for the first time, automatically assumes that the two Lermans are idiots and speaks to them in the worst kind of pidgin English. We friends, you give magic talk boxes? That's Terence making fun of racists. Unfortunately, on TV, Ian Martyr's character gets an unfortunate ethnic slur about Chinese people, which Terence unfortunately puts in the book. We saw something different when Terence de-ethnicized Julius Silverstein in the Web of Fear novelization, as Bill Evenson and I discussed back in Episode 24, and we'll see a little more of that when we come to Episode 37 and the Talons of Wang Chiang, and I haven't found a volunteer to discuss the Talons of Wang Chiang book on this program yet, and it's pretty easy to see why. Turning back to more frivolous matters, page 39 of my copy of the book, the 1984 5th edition, contains the typo octagonal. Whoops. Going back to my original point, the book is a little bare bones compared to the TV serial, but Terence's cuts do sometimes have an editorial point. His reorganizing of the narrative, which makes comparing the book to the TV transcript such a time-consuming affair, may be a vestige of an earlier draft script, but Terence still remembers to insert character touches. Peter Halliday's character is described on page 42 as old-fashioned and conservative, but also fair-minded. Terence reimagines how the scope works,
in a way that would have been very difficult to achieve on TV. Quote, the viewing apparatus of the scope produced a mild hypnotic effect, making the viewer feel part of the scene he was witnessing. Immediately, the three Minorans seemed to have left the familiar bustle of the spaceport and to be standing on some bleak alien planet. Wow. There's also a line in the book, not on TV, where Kallak wonders frustratingly when the Earthlings in the scope are going to do something, which might well have been the reaction of many viewers watching this story in real time in 1973. Vorg's observation, both on TV in Episode 2 and in the book on page 43, that the Ogrons were used as servants by the Daleks, would have been a spoiler for the very next televised story, Frontier in Space, except the TV episode was shot the year before Frontier, and the novelization came out 3 books after Doctor Who and the Space War, which we covered here back on episode 25. In Chapter 5, after the Doctor and Joe leave the SS Bernice and penetrate the inside of the scope, this is all heavily reminiscent of what the two Doctors will be doing in about a dozen years, talking of Tellurians, then the Doctor and his female companion clambering around inside an indoor maze of pipes and conduits. Terrence comes up with a nice simile from Joe's POV. Joe felt like an ant that had wandered inside the back of a television set, very small, very vulnerable, and very much out of place. End quote. Terrence replaces Tellurian with Terran in the books, as Pete mentioned earlier. That's why they call him Terran Siddix. And yes, I wrote that joke before Pete made his, but let's give us both credit. Meanwhile, The Doctor, written by Terrence to match Pertwee's very physical performance, is so enthusiastic at the machinery that, quote, he seemed to have completely forgotten all their problems. Chapter 5 ends with another mini cliffhanger, a beat not on TV, where Vorg is afraid that the Minoran Eradicator will destroy his machine, and Sherna is upset that all the specimens inside might be destroyed. This is not TV dialogue, although Terrence omits a different beat where it turns out that Vorg's credentials to travel to Interminor are a forgery. While the book is demonstrably shorter and simpler than some of Terrence's earlier work, when he finds a point, he runs with it. Describing Kallak's politically devious maneuvering in Chapter 6, he gets off one terrific paragraph about the isolationist politician that could apply to any number of national or international figures we know about here in the year 2022. Quote, you really think the two Lermans are spies? Kallak looked at Orym. What a gullible fool the fellow was. Of course Kallak didn't believe Vorg and Sherna were spies. Or rather, he didn't much care if they were spies or not. His aim was to use their presence to embarrass Pletrak and his brother Zarb as much as possible. Kallak enjoyed stirring up trouble for its own sake. He was determined to lose no opportunity of making political capital out of Zarb's error in allowing the aliens and their scope to land on their planet. And if I first read this book in 1987, I could not possibly have imagined that in 2022 we were going to be living that in real life. Unfortunately, as good as the politics are, Terrence continues his regrettable habit of having female companions scream where they did not scream on TV. See also Sarah Jane Smith's remarkable fainting habit in Terrence novelizations, which we've talked about a few times on the show earlier. Here's a quote from page 60. Joe screamed. A colossal steel spike was moving along the shaft towards them. The Doctor grabbed Joe and they flattened themselves against the wall. The shaft slid by them, probed about a little, then withdrew. Relieved, Joe watched it go. Then she screamed again. From far down the shaft, an enormous eye was peering at her. On TV, happily, Joe does not scream at all in the corresponding scene. The controversial description of the Drashig, which Pete talked about earlier in the program and put in his poll on Twitter, opens Chapter 7. Here's what Terrence says the Drashigs look like. Joe thought she had never seen anything more terrifying in her life. The creature was something between a dinosaur and a dragon, with a squat body, powerful clawed legs, a sinuous neck, and a mouth that seemed to contain not two, but at least a dozen rows of enormous razor-edged teeth. The eyes were small and blinking, the nostrils huge and flared. I like that description. It's vivid and propulsive. What does bother me, though, is how much of Cherna's TV dialogue is reassigned to Vorg in the book. I expect, like I said earlier, that Terrence is working from the original draft, and the actress was probably reallocated some of Vorg's lines in rehearsal in order to give her something more to do. We'll see a similar example when we come to the Power of Krull novelization in several more months. Chapter 7 is another interesting example of discontinuity between two TV stories, when the books are published out of order, and something in the later book contradicts an event from the earlier book. We read Doctor Who and the Planet of the Spiders here back in episode 16 with Graham Burke, and that book, based on a TV episode made 3 years after Carnival of Monsters, features a flashback to the Doctor using his sonic screwdriver to ignite some marsh gas and blow up some drashigs. You remember, Professor Clegg holds on to the screwdriver and sees the clip. Oh, and later dies of a heart attack or dies of fright, but that's not important right now. But Carnival of Monsters had not yet been novelized when Terrence wrote that scene for the Planet of the Spiders novelization. And come to find out, the actual novelization of Carnival of Monsters, now written a couple of years after Spiders came out, has the Doctor blow up drashigs with a flare pistol from the SS Bernice, not the sonic screwdriver. So now the books don't match up. A scene in one novelization flashing back to a scene that in print never happened. And yet, Terrence writes the drashing chase scene so well that it just doesn't matter. Here's a quote. The Doctor felt the weight of the flare pistol in his hand, a puny weapon against three such terrors. And yet, there was another eruption beneath the swamp, another whiff of stinking marsh gas. The Doctor sniffed, analyzing the contents of that smell. Mostly hydrogen, he muttered. Should be highly flammable. Then everything happened at once. The three drashings caught their scent together. All three bellowed and charged. There was another eruption of marsh gas just in front of the charging drashings. The Doctor fired the flare pistol into the heart of it. The marsh gas eruption turned into a volcano of flame enveloping the drashings. Bellowing in rage and pain, they turned and fled, hiding from the flames beneath the swamp mud. The Doctor threw aside the empty flare pistol. They turned and ran for the cave. When the Drashig attacks the SS Bernice early in Chapter 8, Terrence does not stint on the violence. Check out this passage. This is from the bottom of page 79. Suddenly, the monster's slavering head appeared at the saloon window. Claire screamed. Daly fired a long, raking burst with the submachine gun, pouring the entire magazine of 45 caliber bullets into the Drashig's body. At the same time, the captain and crew were firing their rifles into its flanks. Not even a Drashig could stand up to such a hail of bullets. Torn almost to pieces, the monster lurched back roaring and collapsed on the edge of the deck. The weight of the body smashed through the deck rails, and the dying monster slithered slowly into the sea. Everyone stopped shooting, and an uncanny silence fell. Only the blood-stained, bullet-torn deck showed that a battle had just taken place. Now, bear in mind that this is the same book where Terrence would not tell us what the Doctor was drinking, even though the Doctor had ordered an alcoholic beverage on TV. And no, that is not quite how that battle between the crew of the SS Bernice and the Drashigs happened on television. Now, while the book does cut out a fair bit of TV dialogue, it also adds some scenes. In Chapter 8, Daly and Claire and Andrews forget about Joe in mid-conversation as the miniscope time loop resets itself. That's a cool, eerie moment. But on TV, the scene opened with the reset itself, losing the moment where they forget about Joe in mid-sentence. The restructuring of the book is especially evident in the Episode 3 material, which on TV is made up of lots of cuts, which suggest leaps forward in the action. The book, where everything is more sequential, contains transitions, which the TV series can suggest visually. In the book, the Doctor takes a death-defying leap down a miniscope shaft after his rope runs short, and Terrence writes he bent his legs as he hit the bottom and rolled over on one shoulder like a parachutist. That would have been a great Terry Walsh stunt on TV, but the televised episode has to make do without it. The restructuring also messes with the square 3 chapters per episode format. Episode 1 ends with Chapter 3, and Episode 2 ends with Chapter 6, but the Episode 3 material runs out just 4.5 pages into Chapter 9, rather than ending with Chapter 9, as it would in most later Terrence books. And you'll see that Pete and I talked about that a little bit earlier in the program. The humor in the book is not just political. When the Doctor grew only to normal size and did nothing more threatening than lay on the floor unconscious, the panic died down. Or after he meets Michael Wisher's character. It took more than a little sarcasm to worry the Doctor. There was simply no time at all for the nonsense of imprisonment and interrogation that usually followed unexplained arrival on some alien planet. And the Doctor's manner was, quote, that of some high court judge, all too used to seeing petty criminals trying to wriggle out of their responsibilities. This is perhaps a bit less interesting to 9-year-old readers, but as someone nearly 40 years past that, it's quite engaging and realistic. Here's another Terrence quote. The Doctor was gambling that, like all authoritarians, they would harass and bully anyone who seemed weaker than themselves, while responding favorably to a display of force and bluster. Vorg, quote, a born coward, terrified by all authority, was lost in wonder at the way this tall, elegant figure had dealt with the officials. This scene takes up the entirety of Chapter 10. One would like to imagine that Terrence wrote this whole chapter in one sitting, so energized was he by all the bickering and politicking and scheming and conniving. It is, in fact, even sharper in the book than on TV, where a lot of Kallax's razor-sharp lines, which you see in the book, had been reassigned to the much duller Orym on screen. Let's give it a listen.
Will you kindly stop referring to me as the creature, sir? Or I may well become exceedingly hostile.
Silence! This tribunal is deliberating.
The tribunal is not deliberating. The tribunal is arguing. Quite nonsensically, if I may say so.
A tribunal will not tolerate insolence from unauthorized life forms.
Will one of you kindly explain to me exactly where I am? Which planet I'm in?
You are on Inter Minor.
Inter Minor? But not Metabilis 3, the famous blue planet of the Actian galaxy?
Oh, no.
I see. Oh, thank heavens the TARDIS is safe, anyway.
This container is yours?
Yes, it is indeed. Ah, yes. Just as I thought. A miniscope. Now, this is outrageous. Who is responsible for this device? Is it yours?
Certainly not. It is the property of this Lerman. The female is his assistant.
And you, sir, you are...
Chairman Pletrak of the Admissions Tribunal.
One wonders why the tribunal is submitting to questioning by this creature. Shouldn't it be the other way round?
Well, I'm sorry to have to tell you, gentlemen, but you are all in very serious trouble.
One almost admires its audacity.
You are, I take it, the representatives of authority on this planet.
One's authority comes direct from President Zarb himself.
Then you have allowed the importation and the operation of a machine that is expressly forbidden by intergalactic law.
One did not allow it. One has already ordered the deportation of the Lermans and their machine.
But for the moment, the machine is here, and it is in operation. Surely you'll scarcely deny that.
Well, strictly speaking, one must concede that, in a sense...
Then you are responsible, are you not? As a direct result of your carelessness, my young companion is trapped inside this machine, in a situation of extreme peril.
One is forced to remind you that the question before this tribunal is your own eradication as a menace to public health.
You will allow me to rescue my young companion and give what help I can to the rest of the unfortunates trapped in here, then I am prepared to overlook the entire matter.
One is indeed overwhelmed.
Speaking of Terrence restructuring the text to have fun in telling the story, there's a scene on TV in episode 4 where Vorg and Sherna watch the Doctor, who's trying to repair the miniscope before the Drashigs escape, and Vorg says, you know, Sherna, he could lose that nose of his, just like that. That's an ordinary, perhaps forgettable line. Terrence, however, decides to make us remember it forever. On page 105, he instead has Vorg say, he could lose that long nose of his, you know, just like that. I'd never noticed that change before this read, but I can't stop giggling. There are all sorts of editorial comments, too. In chapter 11, Orym states the obvious with his usual maddening calm, or is described as slow-witted, or Vorg struggles to remember, quote, all these technicalities after the Doctor tries to teach him how to flip two switches, and Pletrak has the aggravating suspicion that the Doctor isn't really listening to him. Spoiler alert, he's not. Terence really picks up the pace in Chapter 12, no longer stringing together short TV scenes into longer sequences, but now having single paragraph scenes in quick succession. We see Kallik open the hatch in the scope, from which the Drashigs escape and promptly eat him. We see Vorg chivalrously rescue Sherna from a Drashig. We see Ogrons and Cybermen and even Ice Warriors transported home from the scope, well above and beyond what we saw on television. Major Daly even gets to retain memories of his time with the Doctor, and Joe, and the Plesiosaurs and Drashigs, albeit in confusing dream fragment format. And where a lot of Sherna's lines on TV are given to Vorg in the book she at least gets the last word. In both formats, Peter Halliday gets a line about how Vorg's valor in manning the Eradicator and blasting down the Drashigs will be long remembered in the book, or not forgotten on TV. But only in the book does Sherna add, "It will, if he has anything to do with it." Now, again, as I said earlier, this is not one of my all-time favorite television stories, and it's not in my upper tier of Target books either. It's not one of the books that I read over and over and over again. However, comparing the book to the television episode was very rewarding because there were lots and lots and lots of changes. If you had asked me, I would have thought that the book was just basically a transcription of the TV scripts with a lot of Terence's observational humor thrown in. But there's a lot of reworking and a lot of thought put into it and a lot of funny editorials, especially the bits about the Doctor's long nose or Terence cutting out the alcoholic beverages which the Doctor likes to imbibe. Next time, we jump ahead another month to February 1977, and we are no longer in the middle of a run of three straight Terence Dix books, and we are no longer doing a lighthearted or satirical political commentary. We are moving ahead to the Philip Hinchcliffe era. We are moving forward to Doctor Who's Gothic Horror Days. No Touch podcast. Could be dangerous. We'll be discussing Doctor Who and the Seeds of Doom with a very special guest. And if you're listening carefully, there is a hint as to who that guest will be. We'll see you next week. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. I'm Jason, your host and editor and producer. Special thanks to my special guest, Pete Lambert. This podcast can now be found on iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at anchor.fm/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels. Then you can also find me on the Trap One podcast from time to time, including last week's episode about Galaxy 4, in which Pete also appeared. I write about Doctor Who on Twitter, using the hashtag Doctor Who Pilgrimage, that's Dr. Who Pilgrimage. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Next time, we're discussing another novelization, and we'll again be joined by a very special guest. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.